Greetings, savory inferiors, and welcome to Vampire Insider, the unofficial podcast celebrating the immortal universe of Anne Rice, including Interview with the Vampire and the Mayfair Witches, beginning January 5th on AMC Plus and January 8th on AMC. Each week we discuss and analyze the episodes played. Last week we discussed The Vampire Lestat. This week, we're going to be discussing The Vampire Lestat again, except this time in relation to the modern idea of the anti-hero. But before we get into all that, I would like to greet my co-hosts. Hello, Christina LaRusso. Hello, Joanne Palumbo.
How's it going, Mark?
Great.
Hello. Hello, everyone.
Great greeting. Hi. That's really strong. Great.
It was strong. It was powerful. I am here. I am entering the virtual room.
Okay. So, Christina, why don't you tell us a little bit about the concept of an antihero?
An antihero is a character who is more realistic than a hero. A hero is just a virtuous guy.
Right.
Who might be going through some things where he might make some mistakes or missteps, but generally, he's on the hero's path. He is starting at X and he is going to end up at Y or Z, and he is going to improve along the path. His arc is going to be a positive arc.
Right. He's morally good.
He's morally good. He doesn't struggle.
He's righteous.
He is righteous. Antiheroes, on the other hand, are realistic characters who struggle, who say, well, I want what's best for me, but what's best for me, the way to get what's best for me, is not necessarily on that righteous path. It may be a circuitous path, and there's not necessarily a positive arc.
They fundamentally believe that they're righteous in some ways. They, even though they know they're doing something wrong, right? They kind of feel like I have to be wrong to get to the right.
So there's a very good example of this, and it's Michael Corleone in The Godfather. And he says, Sonny, it's not personal, it's business.
Right. The antihero is at best morally ambiguous, often just a bad guy that's charismatic enough to carry the show. Would you agree with that?
Well, yes, but he's a realistic guy. It's not even a bad guy. It's a realistic guy. They struggle with real life's things. So there are things that are the hurdles that are put in their path, and they may do the right thing to get over that hurdle. They may do the, what would be the
morally questionable
thing to get around that hero or that hurdle.
I don't think you can describe an anti-hero without including in there the fact that they're going to do some morally questionable things.
Otherwise,
they're not really just a realistic hero. They're actually going to do some bad things.
They may do bad things, but that is actually much more realistic than a hero who is always going to try to do the morally correct thing. The hero may fail in that. They may stumble, but their goal is always to do the morally correct thing, I think. And anti-heroes are going to be like, well, I just want to get ahead.
Well, I think the number one person that comes to my mind, or character, I should say, is Damon Salvatore.
Okay. Tell us why he's an anti-hero.
All roads lead back to The Vampire Diaries.
Yes, for you, they certainly do.
Which I would like everyone to know, I'm starting my 10th rewatch this evening. Ugh,
what is wrong with you?
It's that good of a show, Mark. But anyway, the reason that Damon is the anti-hero is that he, you know, whatever problems the group is facing and things like that, he puts his own selfish needs ahead of everybody else's to, you know, he's always the one that will do the bad thing that they don't want to do.
So for an anti-hero, the end justifies the means.
Absolutely. They think they're doing something righteous and they're maybe in their own mind, you know, because their priorities are different than that of a law-abiding citizen or a morally less bankrupt person would do. I think another great, I guess it would be an anti-heroine is that comes to mind that's very current is Beth Dutton on Yellowstone. She's the bad girl. She's comes from a place of power, influence, money. She's beautiful, but she is an evil, ruthless bitch that will stop at nothing to get what she wants. Again, follows that path of, I don't care who gets hurt in my way. I have to get what's best for, in this case, her family. There always seems to be a third party that the antihero thinks that they are doing the best for. It doesn't always necessarily have to be even self-serving.
Christina, who are your examples of antiheroes that you like?
Walter White.
Yes. Breaking Bad. Mm-hmm.
Breaking Bad. I would say that he's an antihero. I think that Jesse Pinkman is actually a hero.
Yeah.
I think Jesse's on the heroes.
He's a bit of an antihero too, though, because he's morally questionable. He's certainly not a complete white knight.
Right? No, not white knight, but he's on the hero's journey.
Okay.
I think that Jesse is on the hero's journey. I think Walter is the antihero. I think that he says the ends justify the means. And Joanne, to your point, he initially puts it in this sort of framework where I'm doing what I'm doing. I'm breaking bad because I need to support my family when I'm gone. Right. But in the end, when he is confronted by Skyler, he says, I did it because I liked it.
Yeah,
ultimately, I loved doing it. I loved the way that it made me feel. So it wasn't altruistic. It was very selfish. I think that a lot of antiheroes will couch things because they know better in terms of I'm doing this for the good of my family. I'm doing this for a greater good, or I'm doing this because it's, I don't know, like,
because it makes me feel good.
Well, in the end, it is because sometimes it makes them feel
bad
good.
Things make people feel good.
And that's right. But that's the realistic. And that's what I think that people, particularly when these guys were rising to prominence, they connected with that. Mark, who's your antihero example?
It was less extreme for me than like a Tony Soprano or a Walter White, who are like legitimately doing horrible, bad things, mm-hmm. even if they are likable in some level. To me, it was always a guy like Han Solo. He's basically on the side of good, but he's also a flawed human being. He's selfish on some level until, you know, really the very end. For me, he was the antihero. Luke is the hero, mm-hmm. right, of the story. Han Solo was a rascal. He initially gets involved because he's getting paid to be involved. Mm-hmm. And even when he's successful, he's like, I want to get my treasure and GTFO. So he was definitely an antihero in the earlier forms of that concept, right?
Agreed.
So, Christina, why don't you tell us a little bit about the evolution of the antihero 1.0 to the antihero 2.0?
All right. So we all watched this really, I thought, informative YouTube video, and we'll put that in our episode notes, so anybody who wants to watch it will be able to watch it. And it was about this evolution. And what they are essentially saying is, initially, the antihero is a white male who is transgressive. All of the things that we've been describing, so the Michael Corleones, the Han Solos, the Walter Whites, Damon Salvatore even.
Absolutely.
All of these guys are the 1.0 antihero. White men, characters who are facing real life or imaginary issues, but their goal in life is single focused, and they do whatever they can do to get to reach that goal. They don't necessarily have to have a redemption arc. They just are who they are. And we kind of celebrate, like, Walter White is honestly kind of the guy that we look at or to look at who says, you know what? I did all of those things. I'm a badass. And yeah. I enjoyed being a badass. At a certain point, I was a badass for the sake of being a badass.
I am the one who knocks,
right? You think that someone else comes to knock. Skyler, I am the one who knocks. That is like the ultimate badass. And I'm sorry, that is a huge meme. I am the one who knocks.
Yeah.
And who doesn't want to feel that way? Because that's a very powerful and empowered way of feeling. The 2.0 antihero is slightly messier, is slightly more unexpected. Often it is a woman. It is not a white male. But a lot of times it is this sort of different person who is also transgressive, but is having their power not from being a white male, which is what the patriarchy underpins, but it is a woman who is powerful in her own right and who is morally ambiguous, kind of moves outside of the script of womanhood, which is women are kind and nurturing and good, fundamentally good. And these women are saying, I might not be.
How did that narrative even ever start? You guys are dangerous.
Oh, that's just you saying that.
Yeah.
Ultimately, women are thought of as nurturing and good and kind and safe. And what the anti-hero 2.0 is saying is that we are not, women are not safe. They have their own designs and they might be doing transgressive things, but we're complex, right? Like women are as complex as men are. So for instance, they are pointing to people like characters like Skylar White versus Wendy Bird in Ozark. They are both women who are intelligent. They kind of look the same, blonde and attractive. They're both intelligent. And then they have husbands who are intelligent, transgressive characters as well. But Skylar becomes this hated character. And I hate her. I hate Skylar. I think she's terrible.
So here's, I think there's Wendy a problem. I think there's
you
a problem.
You hate Wendy?
Well, I hated Wendy. I wish she would have bit it at the end.
I have a problem with that characterization.
Okay, tell me why.
Because one thing I think you have to do is be able to distinguish a anti-hero from a villain.
Wendy's not a villain. Skylar's not a villain.
They're not here. She's not an anti-hero because they're not designed to be attractive as a character.
Wendy is designed to be attractive as a character.
Now we don't. No, they failed. but I think that's one thing you do have to do as you're discussing antiheroes is to be able to point out how they're not a villain.
Wendy is the moral equivalent to Marty. They're equally bad.
Marty's an antihero.
Oh, she was worse than Marty.
You think Wendy is worse than Marty? I think they're both. I think they're equally bad.
You know who I did love, who was a great antihero, and you might say she's a villain. I don't know. Gemma Teller from Sons of Anarchy.
Didn't watch the show.
Oh, you never watched Sons?
You never seen Sons of Anarchy?
I've seen like a couple of art.
You oughta.
Is that Gemma was Mrs. Jackson's Bundy?
Mom. Yeah, okay. Peg Bundy. Her character, I mean, I don't know. I wish, Mark, you had seen it so you could say if you think she was a villain or an antihero. But
she was a villain on Married with Children, I'll tell you that.
Hated Tara. Well, anyway, in our documentary that we watched, these women are being held up as anti-hero 2.0.
I will give
2.0.
You, I think, a better example.
All right.
Uma Thurman in Kill Bill. Because she is the main character, but she doesn't really fit the heroic paradigm, right? Because she's out there murdering people. I think she's qualified as an anti-hero. But who are the other anti-hero 2.0s? They're not all women. Right?
Oh, no. A lot of them are women, though.
Yeah.
That's because they say in this day and age, it's tough for a white man to play an anti-hero because we're in the age of Me Too. You can't excuse a white male's bad behavior. They have to almost be villains to be able to be acceptable.
And do you think that is one of the differences is that with an anti-hero, they have these bad behaviors, but we forgive them because they are performing some role in some heroic style role in the story. And with a villain, we don't excuse them, right? We just say they're a bad person. They're opposed to the hero of the story. We're not willing to overlook or excuse in any way their bad behavior.
We can still have an anti-hero, but it is harder for it to be a white male than a woman. Of color, a woman, a white woman, a man of color. You can have all of those things that are anti-heroes. It is harder to forgive a white male anti-hero in this day and age. It's harder to forgive. In fact, they point out that Frank Underwood as a character was written out because Kevin Spacey's real life behavior made him untenable in this day and age.
Yeah.
And they
that's not really the same thing, though. That's the care, that's the actor's life intruding on the story. So that's not really what we're talking about.
But no, it is what we're talking about, because of course, if in that video that I sent you guys, they talk about that and they say that in this day and age of Me Too, you can't have even a problematic actor who isn't, you can't support an anti-hero if the actor who is playing him is problematic.
Yeah, I totally, yeah, I think that makes a lot of sense, where the Me Too environment is less tolerant of those types of characters, because you do have to, and I would argue, you have to, for an anti-hero to not just be a villain, is you have to, he has to be somewhat sympathetic, and you have to be attracted to the character, not sexually or whatever, although certainly I think we'll find in this case that that is true, but you have to be willing to overlook their rascally or even bad qualities in order for them to be an anti-hero and not just a villain. Do you agree with that, ladies?
I agree. I think that we're going to, as this discussion continues, understand that Lestat, as he's portrayed on the television series, is not necessarily an anti-hero. I think he's a villain.
We'll see.
I agree 100% with that. I don't think Lestat is the anti-hero in this story. He is the villain, like you said, 100%. Do you think that Claudia is the anti-hero?
No. Yes. Yeah, see, Joe and I are like, yeah, she's the anti-hero. No. And I think she's going to have her comeuppance. So I guess what we ought to do is maybe pivot to the vampire Lestat and the series. Let's just talk about something that we didn't touch on last week, which is Anne Rice and her authorship.
What's going on with her?
Vampire
Girl has some issues.
she does, especially when you get to some of the other books. It's not as evident in The Vampire Lestat. It is a little, we've touched on the incest with his mother, the sort of incestual themes. It's not really full. I mean, it is and it isn't. But let's talk about stylistic choices.
And this is going
to become more evident as time goes on and we read other of her books together. At a certain point, Anne Rice eschews editors. She sort of gets to the stage in her career where she doesn't like edit. She's like, I don't want an editor. And they go, okay, that's fine.
I mean,
you edit your own book. You're Anne Rice. You're going to make us a lot of money no matter what you throw out there. Even in these novels, and we joked about it a little bit last week when we said that if she cut out certain phrases or you know, turns of phrases or words, that her book would be,
It'd be a little bit lighter.
What do you think about her writing?
We rely on her for this entire podcast, so I'm only going to say good things about her.
I think it's fair to be critical.
I think you can legitimately say that there are times when her prose gets a little purple.
Yeah.
Right? And she definitely has a couple of her favorite phrases, right? Preternatural is going to show up a lot.
Devil's Road. Savage Garden.
Those three show up a lot, right? It's kind of like reading the Hardy Boys and see how often they talk about the midriff or the solar plexus.
Sock him in the jaw.
Yeah.
I'm going to sock you in the mouth.
But I mean, in general, I mean, she tells a good story.
Is she
the greatest technical writer of all time? No. And I think, honestly, if she had an editor or if her editor was a little bit more savage, you could really pare those books down from, you know, 1,200 pages to maybe 700.
No one needs to make her into Hemingway.
No, absolutely not. Like, I don't, and that's not what I'd be looking for. But she does, I mean, I would say that she does have some extra words in there.
She does, and I think that there is a lot of, it's not really exposition as much as it is, she gets really into her own head. And I think a lot of the stuff that she's talking about is just stream of consciousness fantasy stuff that clutters what is otherwise a really good story. Not as much in The Vampire Lestat. It's more in the future books.
Yeah.
But what I see her doing in The Vampire Lestat that I didn't see her doing in Interview with a Vampire is stage setting. So she is in the Interview with the Vampire. I kind of felt like that might have been a book that she thought, this is, I'm one and done, right? Like, I'm writing this book. This is my book. Here is where it's going to end. Then she goes, well, did it?
I like that character.
I like Lestat.
Did you know that it only took her 5 weeks to write Interview?
No, I didn't know that.
Yeah, she wrote it in 5 weeks.
Really? I thought that, well, I know that she had started it and then came back to it. And maybe that last, when she came back to it, because it was a short story originally. So maybe it took her 5 weeks to do the revision or turn the short story into the novel length. But what I see happening is, and she does it in others of her novels, right? So she is writing The Vampire Lestat, but she's foreshadowing a shit ton of stuff that is going to happen.
Well, she has this whole universe.
She has this whole thing that she's building in her mind, right? So she's saying, okay, I'm writing The Vampire Lestat, but I'm also foreshadowing Queen of the Damned, right? And then Queen of the Damned and on and on.
Because honestly, you can tell The Vampire Lestat without Those Who Must Be Kept.
You could.
But she wants those in a future book. So she's laying that groundwork.
Right.
Is that the argument?
That's the argument. She does it in The Witches, too. She's talking about the Mayfair Witches, and she's laying the groundwork for what comes next in Lasher.
Right. And what comes next is a lot of incest.
So my take on Anne Rice is that I love the stories she tells. But technically, is she the greatest writer in the history of writers?
I know, but you can handle all the hate email when it starts rolling in.
No, it's not that. Look, I appreciate her. I am not a fan. I love her work, but as a fan, I am able to say she could have done with some editing. Yeah. There's some.
Well, I think a lot of people are going to overlook her writing style or her flaws or whatever you want to call it, because of this universe that she was able to create, that here we are nearly 50 years later from when she, I think it was
76.
But 68 was with the short story that was what Interview spanned from. So you're talking a really long time. And here we are still talking about it. They're still making TV shows about it. Maybe she could have done better with her writing or better editing, but that does not take away from the universe that she created and the imagination that she had. I mean, and what a wild world she was able to dream up in her head.
Oh, 100%.
And that's really, I think, the maybe undeserved, but the knock on a genre novel. You know, literary snobs look down on genre novels and they're more concerned with, you know, creating that dazzling world and hitting the tropes and all that stuff. And less concerned with the hardcore craft of writing. And I think you can say you can level that criticism a bit on her because she really is saved by the fact that, first of all, the writing is not abysmal or anything.
No, it's great, right? Yeah. I mean, she uses words well.
She's a good writer. And I think she's saved by the fact that her novel evokes what her readers want. They want to see that sexy vampire. They want that interesting setting. They want to know that the world has some kind of, you know, magic system that, you know, applies to all these characters. And there's enough interesting things going on in there. And the characters are compelling that they'll overlook the fact that she used 100 words to say something that you might be able to say in 30.
I have something that this is kind of just provoked a question in my mind. Remove Anne Rice from the world. Would we still be as fascinated as we are with vampires? Do you think that she's single-handedly responsible for the vast majority of a lot of people that have fallen in love with the vampire?
She was definitely a major force in transforming the vampire, or completing, I would say, the transformation of the vampire from the terrifying, horrific, ugly monster to the suave, sexy beast.
I'm going to be harder core on this. I'm going to give a lot more credit to her. I'm going to say that we do not have Edward Cullen. We do not have Damon Salvatore.
Oh, I think
we do
that's
not.
Right.
I don't think we have that unless we have Anne Rice, who says,
I agree.
We don't need to understand how to kill the vampire. We just need to understand what it is to be a vampire. And vampire in this situation, in her books, is vampire, but it is also allegorically outsider. And this goes to the question that I posed on Twitter, which was, you know, Lestat, he's a problematic character, especially now how he's been framed in this series. But like, what is it that you love about Lestat? Because there are huge, huge Lestat fans. You can walk away from Interview with the Vampire and say, Lestat's a dick. He's yeah. just a dick. And he himself in Vampire Lestat says, Louis saw me as this really uncouth, badly behaved person, but I was actually an aristocrat.
Yeah. I was a badly behaved aristocrat.
Like, I was what Louis aspired to be as yeah. That planter class in the South. I mean, and we're talking just about the book now, not the TV series, but the planter class in the South aspired to be
aristocracy.
They had a misapprehension, perhaps, of what aristocracy was. Lestat came and said, I was aristocracy. I yeah. may not have been Parisian
I
aristocracy.
I was a shabby aristocrat.
But I was aristocracy. My bloodline.
I was the wish version of that.
Yeah, exactly.
But my family was aristocrat, and we were, you know, from the time of Charlemagne, we for centuries went back.
Yeah.
Louis was looking for something that existed in Ivanhoe. But the point here is that if you walk away from the Interview with the Vampire, you come away with Louis's interpretation of who yes. Lestat is. You read the vampire Lestat, and Lestat's like, ha ha, I'm actually the Brat Prince.
Yeah.
The nascent stage of the Brat Prince, because he doesn't become the prince until multiple books later. Right. But this is who I am. I'm this charismatic guy who's funny and who is all of these things. And so when I posed the question on Twitter, why do you like Lestat? We got some great answers. Lestat's cat, at Autumn G71919514, said, I didn't initially like Lestat after first reading Interview with the Vampire. I fell in love with him after reading The Vampire Lestat. I love his spirit. And as he states in the series, his capacity for enduring, a fallen angel who's never allowed his clipped wings to hold him back.
Oh, I like that.
Right?
There you go.
Yeah.
What else?
I like that a lot.
So then let's listen to some other things that people said about Lestat. This is Rainbow Bright at Jack Harkness. J-A-C-K-H-A-R.
That's a
K-N.
That's a Whoverse reference, by the
E-S-S,
way.
Said, when I started these books, I was a teenager and my dad was sick with cancer. So I took Lestat's capacity to endure everything that was meant to knock him down as a guide to help myself get through. I love him because he taught me how to hold my head high, move forward, and endure. Endurance is always going to be one of those things that we come back to with Lestat. All Things Sam Reed, and they're at is at All Things Sam Reed, said, first, I like that they chose an actor like Sam Reed to play him, as he can show vulnerability and anger and passion in just one character. Then Lestat is an outsider, so I like that. So here's someone called Hi, I'm Daisy, at Daisy L. Draper 1. On Twitter said, I always loved him and often had to defend him against my friends, and I realized they had all read Interview first. I read The Vampire Lestat first, and I think that's why.
Well, and I think that the difference to me is pretty simple. In Interview, in the novel, in the first novel, Lestat is basically a villain.
Mm-hmm.
In the second book, in The Vampire Lestat, he is an anti-hero. Because the one thing that you can always say about an antihero is they're complicated. Because they're trying to do something that may be right or good, or they have, you know, some kind of good intentions, but they also have an evil side, they misbehave, they're outside society, they transgress, etc. And I think in the show, you're really seeing a lot more of the vampire Lestat than the interview Lestat.
100%. And we talked about that last week.
That's intentional, right? Because it's now supposed to be Louis like, okay, that first story, you know.
Maybe
wasn't perfectly accurate.
And Daniel
accurate acknowledges
it.
Yeah.
That he says, this is what you said before. And now here's what you're saying. And right. Louis says, well, we changed. I changed.
Yeah.
Do we not forgive? I've changed and here's my story now, you know, like I'm going to do this revision and this revision is more correct. Here's somebody at SYLSOLIDOR on Twitter. Her name is Mademoiselle LeSlut Cockmuncher.
All right. Well, we should get that put on a t-shirt.
I'm sorry. Did you say that one more time?
Mademoiselle LeSlut Cockmuncher.
One of those is her middle name?
She says, I love anti-heroes, competent characters of any persuasion, and villains who do whatever they want. Lestat covers so many bases for me. He's tragic, entertaining, transgressive, and powerful. I also love his narrative voice. Continues on to say, the characters I love have almost no overlap with anyone I would like to meet in real life. Magneto, Kaz from Six of Crows, Darrow from Red Rising, Jorge from Prince of Thorns, Lucifer from Paradise Lost. Anyone in that vein is literary catnip to me. But in real life, I would run like hell. And here's the thing. I think that there are a lot of people who would say, I just wish I could meet someone like that.
Yeah, because it's escapist, right?
Joe, yeah.
It's escapist, right? You get to vicariously feel all these like deliciously evil feelings and act in a way that you're unrestrained by society, et cetera. Even though you might, in real life, hopefully, not want to be a wanton murderer and, you know, and turn a train conductor's head into a puppet. But you enjoy that you get to, and I think that that's why actors a lot of times say it's so much fun to play a bad guy, mm-hmm. right? Because they have that thrill of being able to just misbehave without, you know, the real life consequences.
Right. So if you are a Lestat stan, there is a page on Twitter that you ought to be aware of. It is @club_Lestat. It's run by a number of super stans, and they are just posting a bunch of stuff, fun stuff about Lestat as Sam Reed, right?
Are they not just identical at this point?
They are. I mean, for me, they are. I can't read it. I can't read anything without picturing Sam. So Club Lestat says this. And they're speaking as a collective. Yeah. We love his capacity to love with all his heart without holding back, to forgive and to endure. Endure again, right? Like this is a word that continues to come. And Sam in the series that word was put in his mouth by the authors. Forgive and to endure despite the hardships, tough upbringing, and impossible circumstances. We love how dogged he becomes when he's after something and how fearless he is in the face of adversity. We appreciate his vulnerabilities. Many of us relate to his loneliness, his need for love and companionship, and his deep fear of abandonment. We can sympathize with the fact that he can't emotionally regulate his feelings sometimes and can act on impulse. Yet, he lives with few regrets. Most importantly, we love how fiercely he protects who he loves. Finally, we love his playfulness, blind optimism, audacity, and how he throws away the rule book sometimes, and he does it all with flair and a huge bang. He's ridiculously loud and proud, and we are here for it.
You could also use that exact description in the anti-Lestat fan club, because those are also all of his worst qualities. He's dogged, obsessive. Right. He's, you know, loud and proud. Well, he's aggressive and obnoxious. You know, you can flip that around, but they love all his flaws in the way that someone who disliked the character would dislike those things.
I don't think that that's incorrect, but I think that what that says is that there are these really outsized characteristics about him and he's a monster. Right. Like anything that any anti-hero is going to do Lestat's going to do it on 11 because he's a literal monster.
Yeah.
So there's that. And you have to give him a little bit of a pass for that. Now, one of the things that I want to talk about here about Lestat, and this moves away from the book, and that's, it's obviously all of that is in the book. All of those things that we've talked about there are in the book. He endures, he suffers, he struggles through a difficult childhood, a difficult human life, and then he is brought into the vampire life against his will, and he struggles through that. He is left immediately as an orphan, and he has to learn kind of the tricks of the trade. He has immediately an altercation with this superstitious, weird coven, which is at odds largely with where he is in his intellectual understandings, right? Because, of course, we've mentioned he's a man of the Enlightenment. So he goes through all of these things that have been said about him as book Lestat are true. He is problematic and an anti-hero. Now, however, in the TV series, it gets a little tougher because he is all of those things, but he is also a white male in the time post Me Too, in a woke time, right? In a paradigm shift that is becoming even more open to the ideas of constructs rather than hard and fast truths.
Well, I mean, if you look at it just on its face value, right? He's a white male that is brutalizing two people of color.
And that's exactly it. Now, that is not canon. Well, number one, it's not canon that he brutalizes Louis in the same way that he brutalizes Louis in the series.
Right.
He fights with
the factor of them being people of color.
Right. But in this more progressive era in which we are now all existing, in wanting to make the show more representative, which is a great thing to do, they made Lestat an even more problematic character. And I would argue, as I said before, that they have moved him from anti-hero to actual villain. Am I misreading?
I mean, I think that's an interpretation that you can definitely have, right?
As a white woman, it's impossible for me to say if I feel that it's more difficult or makes him more of a villain or whatever the case may be, because they are people of color, because I'm not a person of color. However, just my opinion and just, you know, my life and knowing right from wrong. Yeah, it does make him a villain. If they were white, he would still be a villain.
I mean, if they had Lestat behaving in more stereotypical ways, or if you got the feeling like he was treating them this way because of their color, rather than just the problems in their relationship and his individual foibles, then that's a problem. But there's no evidence that Lestat is horrible to Louis because Louis is mixed race or black.
No, there's not. It's not because he's not hurting him because he's a person of mixed race. He's hurting him because Lestat is who Lestat is.
That's right.
Lestat is hurting out of hurt and rage and all of that. I think everybody can probably see that. But where we get into an issue here is that, and maybe it's not an issue, maybe this is a purposeful way for the showrunners to say, we you know, like, let's have some conversations around this. This is problematic. Let's have some conversations. Is this really an anti-hero? Is anti-hero okay? Or is he just a bad guy?
Yeah.
And do you see the bad guy-ness more because it's playing out on a person of color's body? But if that's what they're trying to do, that's bullshit. That's like saying that for me, that's a problem in the same way that they create a sexual assault scenario on Claudia.
That's what I was just going to say, Christine. Is it that far-fetched that they would do that when we know now that was 100% done on purpose to make, you know, her, you know, when the episode first came out, we're like, maybe it didn't happen. Maybe they didn't do it on purpose, blah, blah, blah. We know now they did. That was Rollin Jones's way of saying, hey, little girl, the world is tough. You just got raped. So I can't say with certainty that the showrunners and everybody are not doing these things on purpose.
And some of it is not necessarily Well, it's problematic. I'm not going to say it's good. I'm not going to say it's not bad. It's problematic, but it certainly causes discussion. And what I see happening, and this is what I want to discuss, is what I see happening on Twitter, which is my primary platform for watching the discussion in the fandom, is that there are people who are saying, you know, this is problematic to see this white guy inflicting this violence on black bodies, because in some ways that's prurient, and in some ways it also inflicts additional trauma on people who have generations of trauma around violence on black bodies or brown bodies.
I think a slightly better way to look at the motivation of that scene is they're trying to remove the temptation to forgive Lestat and say he's just a rascal.
That's right? What I'm saying. Yeah. He's not just an anti-hero anymore. He's a villain.
And maybe he is a villain in this, and maybe it'll change in season 3 or whatever, where he becomes more of an anti-hero in that story. Because in Interview with the Vampire, it's correct to he's the antagonist in the story. There's nobody else to point at as the antagonist of that story. My argument previously was always, these are supernatural, violent, apex predator creatures. If you are, let's just remove the race component just for a second. If you are in a pack of apex predators, how do they settle things?
Violent. As apex
with
predators,
violence.
Yes.
I understand that, you know, you can't take race out of it because they're each of these actors have, you know, a racial and ethnic background. So I understand that it's difficult to see that play out. Well, I understand it in an intellectual way, obviously not personally in any way. But that's because he's a bad guy. And I don't think that there's any justification in the story to say this represents a continuation of white abuse to people of color. What it does is it represents Lestat's abuse of people he's in love with because he's obsessive and narcissistic and violent.
There was another example of that, of kind of a microaggression, when they're standing in front of the incinerator and he's arguing about after he killed the, you know, dabble and fuckery guy, the lawyer. And he said, oh, we're going to start talking about race again. So I get what you are saying, yeah. Mark, and I get what you're saying, Christina. And I think there's also really something in the middle, too, of, yes, there is a racial component to it. And yes, he does kill indiscriminately. It's not like, you know, Lestat's only out there seeking out minorities.
Correct.
To murder. But this reason why it's that much harder, I think, is because it's his domestic partner. It's his love.
Right.
So there's the factor of the love story that's in this that you can't ignore. Claudia is essentially their child. And that familial situation heightens the racial aspect of it. So I think you're both right. But I think there's that middle ground, too.
There's a difference between the people that he kills and how he kills them. Whatever he does to people he's killing to stay alive as a vampire, that is separate from how he's treating the people that he's supposed to love and supposed to care about and potentially protect.
Right, because like, what's this show about? What's the theme? What did Rollin Jones say this show is about?
Oh, a toxic relationship.
That's right. And that's this is what toxic relationships look like.
I agree with you. But what I am saying is what tips this over into Lestat being a different character in this show than he is in the books, is that in the books, it's not playing out in this racially charged way. And he is able to then maintain his role as an anti-hero who is potentially on a redemption arc. His redemption arc now has, the learning curve has increased immeasurably because this violence is playing out on people of color.
So let's say that you find that problematic, which is reasonable, right? What's the solution?
Well, they have to either have him be full-on villain and suffer villain's consequences, or suffer consequences. Now he's.
You mean maybe almost getting murdered?
He's being murdered, right? Of course, this is one. That
I think
the ways
successfully did that part at least.
Well, that's one of the ways, but also, but there's no evening this out.
Do you know what the other way is? And it's not a very good solution. Make everybody the same color.
No, it's a terrible solution.
I'm just saying that's really the only way to avoid that criticism completely is to go back to the movie and have everybody be white.
No, and I mean, that's a stupid way to do that.
That's right.
And actually, what pisses me off about this is that that solution plays into all of those racists who Absolutely. Went and flooded IMDb with all of those complaints about switching races.
That's right. It's a terrible solution.
It's a terrible solution. This alternative is a much better solution is to have him be a villain. Have Lestat be a villain who maybe gets a redemption arc, maybe not. I mean, villains can have a redemption arc.
They can.
Darth Vader. They can have a redemption arc, but Darth Vader has a redemption arc where he dies. In canon, Lestat has a redemption arc where he becomes the Prince of Vampires.
Yeah. Well, I mean, look, they're not going to maybe...
Are you going to reward him for what he's done here? I don't know.
I mean...
Gabrielle is the one who kind of floats that idea. Shouldn't there be a leader of all the vampires? And wouldn't it be wonderful if it's you, Lestat, my son?
It's a little tricky.
She's like fucking Margaret Beaufort.
It's a little tricky to try to impose that kind of clear-cut justice on a complex narrative. If a bad guy does something bad, he has to receive his comeuppance in the sequel. I mean, which is an understandable urge, but it's not very good writing. You have to see where the story goes, and it's possible that someone who is absolutely wicked and irredeemable becomes the Prince of Vampires. Because guess what? That's the kind of guy who would become the Prince of Vampires. But you can't really ask that, you know what, Rolin Jones, I need you to punish Lestat more. Because it made me feel bad that he was doing these horrible things, which, by the way, is perfectly legitimate feeling on the audience's part.
And it would be a perfectly legitimate choice if that happened.
It's a simplistic choice.
I don't know.
Because you're basically saying, okay, guys, we got to balance the scales. Lestat did something bad. Bad people do not always immediately receive comeuppance.
Not immediately,
but it's a much more interesting, complex story if you let the story go where the story goes. And of course, they're also a little bit constrained, not completely, obviously, but they are trying to follow these books, and specific shit happens in each of these books that they're trying to work into it. So having Lestat, you know, brought lower than maybe eating rats in a dump, right, is tricky to do narratively, right? Because that's not what happens in the books. And he's trying to at least keep the spirit of the books. And the spirit of the books is Lestat does a bunch of crazy, evil, wicked shit and never really pays the price for it.
There has been, I mean, it's, I don't want to say like a paradigm shift because that's too strong of a word.
Right.
But where before in the 90s, the late 90s, 2000s, that really was the heyday of antiheroes. And that was in the time where you're going through 9/11 and all of those societal things. So like art responds to life, or maybe life responds to art, maybe.
Sometimes both, yeah.
But maybe both, maybe it's vice versa. Now we are in a day and age where I'm not sure that we want to see just full-on antiheroes. I think we want to see things like look at Ted Lasso, who is a problematic character. He seems positive, but and
he's
we did
not
an
problematic.
Episode.
No, he has problems.
He has problems. Yeah. So we have talked about him in our Gen X Temporaneous podcast where we talked about Ted
Available
Lasso
on all platforms.
Where we talked about Ted Lasso and toxic positivity,
right.
But then also understanding that Ted Lasso is on he's got a character arc. Sure. He seems positive, but we as an audience know that there's a lot of stuff going on.
But he's definitely not an anti-hero.
Not an anti-hero in any way. But I'm saying that society now is maybe more interested and more nuanced. Instead of just an anti-hero, they want someone who is not necessarily an anti-hero, but somebody who's really struggling in life, but is really genuinely trying to be better.
You're making a point earlier, I think, about a consumerist argument, right? Where in this day and age, people don't want to see X or they do want to see Y, right? Mm-hmm. And they don't want to see, this bad guy succeed. And they don't want the show to be all about just this bad guy who's, you know, being violent towards people of color or women, whatever it is. Well, look at a different character. You have someone who's ostensibly the hero of the story. You know, you are entitled to interpret that as saying, okay, Lestat is the villain, Louis is the hero, or Claudia, if you choose, right? You have that ability to find that character there who's not the bad guy.
No, of course. Right?
You have that option.
You have to have the bad guy.
And I'm more of a sola scriptura guy, right? It's whatever the story is, that's what it is. Mm-hmm. And you can bring in all these other things. In fact, you can probably not avoid it. But if you're criticizing a show, criticize it for what the show is, what the show says, what the show shows.
Can you cheer for the villain? Because what I see happening a lot online, and I think what happens online, is that people are criticizing the people who stan Lestat. But I would never criticize someone for liking him because we have a long history of liking anti-heroes.
And she's on our podcast.
Well, you know, I mean, yeah, you're right. She's that'd be rude. Best friends.
She's right here.
No, but there are people who criticize people who like Lestat still. And especially liking Lestat now is a higher difficulty level. Because
there are people who liked Jason from Friday the 13th. They were like, you know, that was, I mean, mostly guys, I think, that was awesome the way he chopped them up or whatever it was, right? That, I mean, people will sometimes cheer for the villain. Does that make them bad people? Eh, not necessarily.
But I think the difference with villain and anti-hero is that you see in the anti-hero things that maybe you would like to do in life, but you know you can't because you'd go to prison or something like that. With the villain, for me anyway, with, you know, with somebody like Jason, like I don't want to run around and chop people up, but I would like to be like the anti-heroine of Beth Dutton and knock the fucking shit out of some people.
100%. That's like I said before, when we were talking about Walter White, who doesn't want to sit there and say, I'm the one who knocks.
Yeah, I'm the badass.
I am the badass. I mean, we see that all the time. We see that all the time on Twitter. We all, probably all three of us, take part in the I'm the one who knocks. Don't fuck with me. Or we're like, you know, if you come for the king, you best not miss.
That's me.
Again, or the queen, right? Like, so that's, I don't feel like I couldn't be a king, Joanne. Like, I don't feel like we have to restrict me to a gender there, the gendered title. But no, like, there is a certain amount of wish fulfillment when you watch a really good anti-hero who's bad, but not that bad. But then when you get, you know, like where we have Lestat right now situated, it's bad and just bad. He has microaggressions to his own partner around race. He is domestically violent. He is, doing the hideous things that he did to Claudia, not only making her watch her first love burn in an incinerator, but also mocking her because she was sexually assaulted using her sexual assault against her as a weapon, right? Like there's a lot of not redeeming things
and that's an accurate portrayal of who Lestat is.
And could he redeem himself? There are a lot of characters now who do bad things. So I'm going to go to what Steph talked about, which is BoJack Horseman. I know it's a cartoon.
Right.
But I'm if you haven't, listeners, watched this fantastic cartoon on Netflix, I would say watch it. Watch it and keep Lestat in mind in watching this. He is a really problematic character, and he does have a redemption arc, sort of. And it's not a linear redemption arc. It is a two steps forward, one step back.
Which is how things should be, right?
Which is how things go in real life. And then at the end, he's punished. He faces consequences, ultimately, for his actions. And he's been, to his credit, in some ways, seeking consequences. And it's almost like he does things, and maybe this is Lestat. He does things to get consequences.
He sabotages himself.
He self-sabotages in order to face consequences. And the consequences never kind of come in the way that are really going to affect change until they do.
Yeah.
And maybe that's realistic. Maybe that's the life. And maybe that's how Lestat is going to be portrayed in this series.
For me, complexity generally, not always, but generally enhances the art, mm-hmm. right? I don't want to see a cookie cutter hero and a cookie cutter villain. That's a bit boring. So if you add complexity, yeah, it's problematic, right? And you make the audience work through some of these issues. That's good. Now you can do it in a bad way. You can come at it from the wrong way, where if only people of color were ever hurt, or if there's any hint that, you know, the bad guy did that because of his feelings of racial superiority, right? That would be the wrong way to do it. Or if he's rewarded by society at the end of the show and there's no criticism of that inherent in the story, totally wrong. But if you have a bad guy doing bad things, that's okay in a story. That is, for me, that is part of the story. So I don't applaud seeing sexual assault or domestic violence, but I understand that bad things are sometimes used in stories in effective ways. And I think that the jury is a little bit out on what their ultimate treatment of Lestat is going to be. Obviously, if they suddenly turn him into a shining golden god with no consequences and everything, that's a more problematic take than him trying to come back from being three quarters murdered and living in a dump. So he's definitely seen some consequences, but it's not a permanent consequence. So it remains to be seen how they decide to deal with that character arc.
I'm okay with those things too, Mark, with the, you know, sexual assault and domestic violence when it's not done gratuitously. And the sexual assault of Claudia was gratuitous. The domestic violence situation, on the other hand, I don't feel that it was. I mean, we've beat this drum a million times.
Yeah.
And we've said it a million times. They're vampires.
I'm going to leave us off with this quote from Twitter. I thought this was an interesting comment, and I want us to comment on this. All right. So this is from Lestat's baby mother at _EMKJAY.
These account names. I know.
I love
they're
it.
Out there.
They are. I mean, they're really intense. But anyway, I'm sorry. At _EMKJAY and says, I love him because I relate so much to his perpetual self-sabotage. He means well deep down, but he destroys everything around him in the process. I can also relate to his issues with control and how monstrous it makes him. I want to curb stomp him and then give him a big hug.
I mean, that's a complicated character, right?
Right.
That's like almost exactly what Louis said when he first met Scott. I wanted to be the man.
And
I wanted to kill
the man. Yeah.
Right. Well, but that's it. Are we Louis in that? Are we Louis who say, I want to be him? And we don't want to kill him necessarily, but we want to say he's a very bad guy. Like, I know he's a bad guy. And I find him attractive.
Yeah.
Stern talking to.
Yes.
You want a stern talking to in the Poconos?
Yes. I might spank him.
Oh. He's a very bad boy. In a heart-shaped jacuzzi.
So I think we'll wrap up here. The only thing else I want to talk about from the vampire Lestat is this. They talk about Marius. She talks about Marius and the vampire Lestat, and she talks about those who must be kept. And I think we see much more of them in future books. That's sort of a tease. But this is what I meant when I said before that she has this tendency to foreshadow what's coming. And she did that more in Vampire Lestat than she did, obviously, in Interview with the Vampire.
Because she had no idea how successful she was going to
be. She didn't know how
she was. She's like, I didn't know I was going to get to write another book.
Right,
I was going to have to go teach English.
Exactly. So we're going to talk much more about those characters as we go forward. Also, Armand, he shows up, obviously, in the Vampire Lestat, but we're going to talk more about him. We have a whole book about Armand. So,
ladies, you better be reading that Mayfair Witches, too.
We are. Mayfair Witches is coming up. I am halfway through the Witching Hour. It's a great book. Joe is going to be starting it soon. speed reading it.
She is. Yes, Joe will be starting it soon because she hasn't started it yet.
Yeah.
And Donnie, you got to read that book, girl.
That's coming. You got a week. You got a week. A weekend.
There's zero chance of her making it. Like a zero, zero Why? Chance. You can't read that. That's a 1,200 page book.
1,050. All right, Joe, do you want to lead us out?
Thanks, everyone, for listening to us. We hope you enjoyed the episode. If you did, please share us with all of your friends. If you would like to follow us on social media, we are on Instagram at vampire_insider_podcast. I promise there'll be more content coming soon. On Twitter, we are at vampire_insider. Thank you, guys. Have a great night. Mark, Christina, good night.
Good night.
Peace out, anti-Cub Scouts.